Leopold I was an epoch-defining monarch, marking the Habsburgs' transition from the multi-continent-spanning empire of Charles V to an empire on the Danube, an empire that would survive until the Great War. The Spanish branch of the Habsburgs under Carlos II, the Bewitched, Leopold's cousin and contemporary, would suffer a period of petrification and then extinction. It looked as if the Austrian branch of the family would fare no better, potentially chased from Vienna by the Turks and usurped as Holy Roman Emperors by the Bourbon dynasty of France. Instead, Leopold was able to avert catastrophe, cover Austria in glory, and forge a new and enduring destiny for the dynasty. It only seemed appropriate that we begin this series on the later Habsburgs with Leopold I. Leopold I was born in 1640, the second son of the reigning Holy Roman Emperor, King of Bohemia, Hungary, and Archduke of Austria, Ferdinand III. As the younger brother of Prince Ferdinand, Leopold was not expected to succeed his father. Ferdinand III's reign was in essence a holding operation for the Habsburgs. Ferdinand II, Leopold's grandfather, had waged war successfully on the Protestants of Germany for a decade, reclaiming Bohemia, eviscerating its once powerful Protestant nobility, and through the military brilliance of the Emperor's Generalissimo Wallenstein, reversed 75 years of Protestant encroachments against Catholics in the Empire through the Edict of Restitution in 1629. Such an accomplishment was quickly reversed by the military intervention of the Swedish king Gustavus Adolphus, and 6 years later, Ferdinand II was forced to accept a new religious settlement, the Peace of Prague. Rather than ensuring peace, the Peace of Prague precipitated a military intervention from France that further exhausted the Habsburgs and devastated the empire. It is within this context of Habsburg decline, to say nothing of relentless slaughter, that Leopold I was born. Fearing that Habsburg control over the imperial title itself was threatened, Leopold's brother was elevated at the age of 13 to co-ruler of Bohemia and Austria alongside his father, and a year later would be crowned as King of Hungary. In 1653, at the age of 20, Prince Ferdinand, now King Ferdinand IV, was crowned King of the Romans and heir to the Holy Roman Crown, forestalling any attempt by France to place the young Louis XIV on the throne instead. This haste in confirming Ferdinand IV was for naught, as a year following his coronation as King of the Romans, he died unexpectedly, leaving Leopold as the heir to the empire. Following the death of his father, Ferdinand III, in 1658, Leopold was elected Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire at the age of 18. Compared to the regal bearing of his older brother, Archdeacon Coxer and the Abbe Pacicelli described the young Emperor Leopold as being of a weak and sickly constitution, low in stature, of a saturnine or depressed complexion, ordinary in his countenance, and distinguished with an unusual portion of the Austrian lip. The hanging lip, peculiar to the House of Habsburg, is so marked in him that the teeth protrude, which somewhat impedes his speech. His gait was stately, slow and deliberate, his air pensive, his address awkward, his manner uncouth, his disposition cold and phlegmatic. Despite his unprepossessing physical features, Leopold was a model of Christian piety. He possessed all the private and domestic virtues. He was pure in his morals, faithful to his marriage bed, a good father, and a kind master. Reserved in public, he was facetious in private company. His Majesty every day hears three masses in succession, at which he remains constantly on his knees. During Lent, court officials and attending foreign dignitaries were obliged to attend 80 services alongside their emperor. Leopold's devout Catholicism led to the charge against him by his Protestant subjects and rivals that he was a bigot, obsessive in defending the rights of the Catholic Church. This was a politic assessment, effective in conjuring up the worst phobias relating to his grandfather, Ferdinand II, his perceived Catholic chauvinism, and the horrific legacy of the Thirty Years' War. If this hostile indictment should leave us with the impression that Leopold was a simpleton, this was far from the case. He received a comprehensive education from the Jesuits, encompassing the study of theology, law, philosophy, the natural sciences, and moreover, astrology and alchemy. He spoke five languages, German, French, Italian, Spanish, and Latin, Latin in whose knowledge and written style he excelled. Enamoured of the arts, he penned fables, studied painting, and composed and performed music. He was called the most learned prince of his age. Indeed, he displayed rather the virtues of a recluse and the acquirements of a professor than the qualifications of a prince. Shortly after Leopold's ascension as emperor, the chief minister of France, Cardinal de Mazarin, died, commencing the personal reign of Louis XIV. A few years later, Philip IV of Spain, the original Sun King, demised, leaving the Spanish throne to an incompetent child, the most extreme product of the Habsburg practice of intermarriage between the Austrian and Spanish branches of the family, a practice of which Leopold would also partake by marrying two of his Habsburg cousins. The Spanish court had become a catacomb. Leopold was left as the principal standard bearer of the Habsburg cause in Europe, inheriting a two centuries long conflict with France, now under a monarch claiming the mantle of Sun King for himself. Though the legacy of Versailles pervades throughout our collective historical memory, Leopold I launched a concerted challenge to the cultural preeminence of the French court. Here I shall read an excerpt from A. Wheatcroft's Cultural History of the Habsburgs. The anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, has introduced the concept of the theatre state. This concept is relevant to the Habsburgs. Leopold seems consciously to have moved beyond the old Habsburg ceremonial structures, the court ceremonials like that of the Golden Fleece, to more public and literally theatrical events. He mounted more than 400 of them. The first major building of his reign, after the extension to his palace of the Hofburg, was a huge wooden theatre designed by Giovanni Bonacci, which backed onto the fortifications behind the Hofburg. This seated up to 1,400 people, with three tiers of galleries and an extraordinary ceiling painted to represent the soaring vault of a Baroque church. Here Leopold's own musical interludes, arias and accompaniments were performed. Over 100 completed works of considerable quality survive, and he took the leading role in a number of elaborate productions. In one of the first masks, he and the young empress took part of Acis and Galatea in an entertainment of the same name and were painted by Jan Thomas in the gold, silver and scarlet costumes that they wore for the occasion. And late in 1667, Leopold took the initiative in presenting a much more didactic drama. Theatrical productions, including masks and operas, were a device frequently used to combine pleasure with a hidden moral or political undertone. At the Stuart courts under James I and Charles I, and in both Italy and in Spain, the mask and the opera were enormously popular. In Madrid, the little theatre of the Buen Retiro was so successful that it was used for public performances as well as those open only to the courtiers. Under Leopold, the arts of the theatre and music and the highly developed skills of the Baroque stage management were pressed into service to present the same Habsburg motifs of dynasty, divine election and continuity in the new manner. In the opera Il Pomo d'Oro, The Golden Apple, written by the court poet Francesco Spara, with music by Marc Antonio Cesti and numerous arias by Leopold himself, the apple for the most beautiful of all women was presented, not to one of the contending goddesses, as in the classical myth, but to the young empress. The final scene, recorded in a set of engravings, published and widely distributed, was the Court of Austrian Glory, which taxed the ingenuity of the stage designers to the uttermost. The curtain rose on a stage where the mounted figure of the emperor in armour was revealed, dead centre, posed atop a pile of Turkish armour, swords, banners and spears. Above him, two-winged putty held a vast victor's circlet made of laurel leaves. To the left and right was a soaring classical colonnade, improbably decorated with vines, trophies of arms, and yet more Ottoman impedimenta. On each column sat more winged putty, wreathed in laurels. High above the figure of Leopold, in the sky, a crowned figure rode a winged horse, with attendant divinities resting on their clouds. Encircling the stage were the personifications of the many lands and cities over which the Habsburgs ruled, both in Europe, as well as one dusky, befeathered figure representing the Indies. Up to this point, the whole confection was no different from any number of similar entertainments of the French or other courts. But the Austrian glory resided in the figures of Leopold's ancestors, mounted in armour, standing on bronze columns, painted with the emblems of their victories. This tradition of presenting the whole Habsburg lineage and animated genealogy can be traced back at least as far as to Maximilian I. He had intended that his tomb at Innsbruck should become a temple of that dynasty, ranging the bronze statues of his ancestors real and imagined around him. In an exercise akin to that of Philip II of Spain, collecting his relics in the Escorial, Maximilian amassed 100 or more saints which he claimed belonged to the House of Habsburg and which were drawn for him by Hans Burkemeyer. The depiction of Leopold as the epitome of Habsburg triumph became a constant theme. In another many-layered allegory on the same theme painted by Gerhard von Horst in 1670, Leopold becomes a rather improbable Hercules, in full Roman armour and a court wig, carrying a huge club, almost as tall as himself. He stands outside a temple on the three-headed hydra he has just slain. This certainly represents the Ottomans, but also the other enemies of the Habsburg dynasty, heresy and rebellion. Despite the classical framework, the iconography is Christian. At his feet sits the Virgin Mary and the infant Christ, wrapped in a cloak of deep, bright Marian blue, which is the dominant hue of the whole image. Crosses pervade the picture, as crucifixes, sword hilts, even the crosspiece of an anchor, the defeated Turks prostrate themselves under the watchful eye of the goddess of war, while a bare-breasted figure of fame places the victor's wreath on Leopold's head. Another angel, with a Habsburg eagle as her headdress, presents a submissive female figure representing the defeated Hungarian allies of the Turks. At the foot of the temple steps the triumphant emperor's pet spaniel, staring adoringly up at him, besides the crown of St. Stephen, again emphasising Leopold's victory over discord. The construction of Louis XIV's iconography of glory as the Sun King was paralleled by its mirror image, the glorification of Leopold and the Habsburgs. But against the individual, solitary glory of Louis XIV, the Habsburgs ranged the traditions of their long lineage. A very similar image to that presented by Van Horst was of Louis XIV alone in his coronation robes, with his foot on the three-headed hellhound Cerberus, and a stave representing Hercules's club, being crowned by victory. This was a statue some 13 feet tall, designed for the Place de Victoire in the heart of Paris. A contemporary described it as a vast winged woman, close behind his back, holding forth a laurel crown over the king's head. The statue bore the dedication to the immortal man, and the marble pedestal carried an inscription listing 10 major achievements of the reign. Around it were grouped 4 bronze captives, 6 bas-reliefs depicting Louis's triumphs, and the 4 torcheres, which were lit every night. The statue was unveiled in 1686 with great ceremony, with music, fireworks, and cannon salvos. Even the king himself came to view his new likeness. Despite surface similarities, the approaches and intentions of Leopold I and Louis XIV were very different. Peter Burke, in his original study of Louis, struggled to take the primacy of Europe, writes, "In the course of the reign, the king distanced himself from the traditional emblems and symbols of regality without abandoning them altogether. Unlike medieval rulers, he did not often wear a crown or hold a scepter or the main de justice, a staff surmounted by a hand. Louis did not often sit on a throne. Among the rare occasions on which he did so were audiences to Algerian and Siamese envoys. One is therefore left with the impression that a throne had come to be regarded as an archaic survival, so exotic that it was simply used to impress Orientals. Even the representation of the king shifted away from the traditional regalia, and often showed him in ordinary clothes, sitting on a chair and holding a baton rather than the sceptre to demonstrate his authority." Burke goes on to point out that in the most famous portrait of Louis by Hyacinthe Rigaud, he holds a sceptre, but upside down, leaning on it rather in the manner of a prop, while his ordinary clothes are visible under the royal mantle. The sword of state was half concealed, and there was no orb. Elsewhere, he points out that the king often appeared in solitary splendour. The Habsburg practice was different in every respect, and the gulf widened. Almost as if to draw themselves apart from the new French model of monarchy, the Habsburgs began to stress the traditional and atavistic elements of their rule. Where Charles V and Philip II might have been portrayed without the emblems of the Habsburg mission, their successors, it seemed, had a greater need for said accoutrements. Leopold I was almost invariably festooned with the trappings of regality, or displayed amid a parade of his ancestors, like his grandfather, Ferdinand II, and his more distant ancestor, Rudolf II. He had a deep interest in the practice of alchemy. When the Augustinian monk and alchemical fraud, Wenzel Seiler, wished to impress Leopold with his skill, he transmuted a large medallion from silver into gold on St. Leopold's Day in 1677. On the face of the medallion, he cast the busts of all 41 emperors, going back to Pharamond, king of the Franks, and finishing with Leopold as the large central figure of the medallion. The medallion and the day of its creation were held to be symbolic for the new Leopoldine Golden Age. Leopold intended that the Golden Age should continue under his son Joseph. He succeeded in arranging his election as King of the Romans in 1690, and when the new king returned to Vienna, the arches under which he passed outstripped anything previously seen in the Habsburg lands, and equaled or exceeded those erected in France. The two vast columns à la Charles V framed the Gate of Honour, designed by Fischer and von Erlach the Elder. Above the central arch was a globe held up on the shoulders of two loathsome giants. In the centre of the globe sat the new Sun King, Joseph, holding high the sceptre of his authority, the effulgent rays of his presence radiating in every direction. Atop the globe, a proud father and mother sat by the side of the wings of an imperial eagle. Banners, angel trumpeters, figures of Hercules, and nubile muses completed the cast. A whole succession of such arches stood along the route into the city. Later generations persisted in the same style of emblematic association. Mary Theresa, kept by her gender from the imperial throne, frequently possessed with the crowns of the kingdoms that she ruled, as in the famous portrait by Martin von Meitens the Younger, where her index finger, resting on the sceptre, the head of which is the miniature of the globe, points suggestively down towards her three crowns on a plush red cushion. Her grandson Francis, the last Holy Roman Emperor and the first Emperor of Austria, was painted by von Ameling in the coronation robes that he never wore, with a crown on his head, a massive sceptre in his hand, the sword of a state prominently exposed, and his neck festooned with a jumble of military and civil orders. The orb is prominently in view, In the case of Francis, the reference is not only to the earlier images of his ancestors, but to Gérard's depiction of Francis's upstart and unwelcome son-in-law, Napoleon Bonaparte, in his velvet and ermine coronation robes, with a great star topped by the imperial eagle of France, no crown but an orb prominently displayed by his side, and on his head not a crown but the victor's laurels in gold. Every aspect of Napoleon's empire was proclaimed in his newly minted sovereignty through his concocted imagery and symbolism. By contrast, Francis, whose title was Emperor of Austria, was as much as a novelty as Napoleon's, and some said possessed an even smaller claim to legality, presented an image of the centuries-old continuity of the Habsburgs. The old tradition of propaganda by publication, which had languished since the days of Maximilian I, was revived. Under Ferdinand III, and more particularly under Leopold I, there was an ever-growing flood of panegyrics on the Habsburgs and their antecedents. Many old texts and manuscripts were issued for the first time, or long-forgotten volumes republished, like the great popular History of the Dynasty by J.J. Fugger, written almost a century before, but not printed until 1682. Some of these volumes were funded by the court, but many more were produced speculatively, knowing that they would find a receptive readership. Thus, during the second half of the century, the output of genealogies and legal treaties advancing the ancient claim of the Habsburgs appeared in hitherto unequalled numbers. One view is that it was a sign of insecurity among the Habsburgs that for the first time they needed to bolster their prestige and position by this form of advertisement. However, these volumes, large and small, also celebrated the capacity and willingness of the Habsburgs to absorb the celestial radiance. Leopold in particular was almost invariably bathed in the light of divine favour, but equally he stood for and on behalf of a family renowned for its sanctity. In image after image he was depicted as the scion of a noble race, and this style of presentation persisted well into the following century. The Habsburgs after Ferdinand II displayed a confidence and determination that had all but lapsed in the days of Rudolf and Matthias. It was the ebullient assurance of the Baroque through which Ferdinand III, and more especially his son, became the focus of a cult of regal divinity. Leopold was an active participant in this myth-making. He has rightly been called the greatest bibliophile among European rulers of the 17th century, but his was more than a mere collecting passion. As Rudolf had sensed the power of images and of magic, Leopold was aware of the power of the written form. He used the resources of his library in Vienna, almost the rival of the Escorial in Spain, to manifest the range, extent, and antiquity of Habsburg power. In this, he was heir to the earlier tradition of Maximilian I, Charles V, and Philip II. Like them, Leopold was a sun king, but the light that shone upon him was the light of Christ. The extent of his aspirations can be seen in the plan for a huge programme of publications, 25 volumes, drawn from the manuscripts and other treasures in the library. Only 8 volumes appeared, but they were sufficient to give a sense of the whole project. Peter Lambasius, his librarian, selected materials which focused attention on the antiquity and power of the Habsburg lineage. The choice of material published in the volumes, their arrangement and juxtaposition, the choice of illustrations, these were no accident. Other projects on a smaller scale told very much the same story. Leopold was the worthy vessel for God's favour, and through him and the House of Austria, light and goodness would be brought into the world. Many of the images of Leopold were produced as prints, and images intended for popular sale. The tradition of the pictorial frontispiece to books, with a strongly dynastic theme, was a peculiarly Austrian development. This provided a visual epitome of the more elaborate themes and intentions of the works. Take, for example, the frontispiece of one poem on the theme of Leopold's greatness. The text, which is in Latin, is a conventional reiteration of the antique genealogy of the Habsburgs. The image is much more than dense, complex, and original. On the left-hand side of the image is a bust of Leopold, his eyes turned up to heaven and crowned with a laurel. The bust rests on an urn carried by two winged putti, and from the urn grows a living laurel tree, which encircles the bust. Above him flies the double-headed imperial eagle, clutching a cushion in its talons on which rests the imperial crown and sceptre. A beam of light shines down from heaven, emanating from the monogram of Christ, IHS, in hoc signo, and is thus the divine light. This divine light falls upon the ram of the Order of the Golden Fleece around Leopold's neck, which is immediately transformed into the monogram of Christ. This in turn beams the divine light onto the world below, and also onto his own portrait, carried by two more putti. So Leopold is doubly impregnated with the divine light. Actually triply, for to complete the scenario, the Virgin Mary touches and transforms the ram IHS with her wand, while with her left hand she points up to heaven. From her breast a radiant light suffuses the emperor. For contemporaries, the implicit meanings in these and similar images would have been immediately apparent. 3 centuries on, and brought up in a largely secular world, many of these pictures are as mysterious to us as Egyptian hieroglyphics. This and many similar engravings display the seamless conjunction of Catholic and dynastic themes in a uniquely Habsburg use of visual communication. The complex and convoluted constructions correspond to a reality actually visible in society. The images of the Counter-Reformation were omnipresent. They extended from the many manifestations of the Virgin Mary, so much favoured by the Emperor Ferdinand II and his descendants, who the new reverence for the national saints, like St. John of Nepomuk, canonized in 1729, to the astonishing profusion of new images and church ornament throughout the Habsburg lands. The festivals of the church were celebrated with an unparalleled dedication and regularity. Leopold is presented as but one of a pantheon of Habsburg rulers, all bathed in the divine light. The underlying motives for his emphatic presentation of traditional regality can only be inferred. But it first developed as the Habsburgs faced new and much more dangerous challenges to their traditional values and practices. As Wheatcroft illustrates, Habsburg idolatry, endowed with Baroque splendour, was in essence a culture war, being waged to justify the continuity of the dynasty at a time when said continuation was in doubt. The premature death of Ferdinand IV had opened a window for France to thwart the election of Leopold as emperor. Mazarin, the chief minister, had hoped to elect a French-aligned prince, a vehicle for French interests into Germany, and possibly a stepping stone for the Bourbons to assume the imperial title for themselves. But Mazarin had underestimated Leopold's father, Ferdinand III. Ferdinand III, having assumed power in the final decade of the Thirty Years' War, spent his 2-decade-long reign attempting to normalise the relationship between the Protestant and Catholic princes of the empire. It can be said that without Ferdinand III, the religious settlement and the peace that held the titular empire together would have failed. Indeed, the Habsburgs could have taken the Peace of Westphalia as their cue to abdicate their interests in Germany, devoting themselves entirely to the rule of their hereditary possessions, Austria, Bohemia, and their small strip of Hungary. Ferdinand III instead opted for a compromise policy, 1 foot in the empire. The wars of religion had been lost. Catholicism would never again be the sole confession of the Holy Roman Empire. But rather than let the rise of France accelerate the demise of the empire, Ferdinand used the implicit threat of French expansion to cast the emperors as the ultimate legal authority of the empire, the guarantor of the German liberty, and the martial defender of the tiny German princelings. Thus, while Mazarin was organising the imperial princes of the Rhine into a French alliance, Ferdinand established a common institution for the empire, the Perpetual Diet of Regensburg. It can be said that the peace of settlements of Augsburg, Prague and Westphalia, a succession of humiliations for the Habsburgs' Catholic policy, had no greater champion than the Habsburg Emperor Ferdinand III. Ferdinand thus set the trend for the later Habsburgs to follow. He was able to ensure the election of Leopold, and Leopold was gifted a formula to stymie French expansion. Nevertheless, Austria still faced an existential crisis. In the 16th century, Francis I of France and Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Sultan, had agreed an alliance against the Habsburgs. In 1660, the Habsburgs were again faced with a resurgent Ottoman Empire and France, the former under the stewardship of a dynasty of talented pashas, the Kapulu, and the latter led by one of the most charismatic and belligerent monarchs in France's history. Since the reign of Ferdinand I, the Habsburgs had claimed to rule Hungary, but were limited to a rump state around Pressburg, modern-day Bratislava. The Ottomans directly administered Buda and indirectly ruled over Hungarian Transylvania. Leopold won his first war against the Ottomans, but his terms were relatively generous, ensuring a 20-year truce so the emperor could devote his energies towards France and to the reduction of Hungary, where there were many Protestants and powerful nobles, such as had been the case in Bohemia before the reign of Ferdinand II. While the truce lasted, Ferdinand attempted to repress the nobles in the Magnates' War, yet skirmishes with Hungarian rebels continued, often with the support of the Ottomans, the Hungarians serving the latter as useful proxies. One such rebel was Thököly, who would go on to establish his own principality in northern Hungary, under the protection of the Ottomans. When the Ottomans would go on to besiege Vienna, they would do so, espousing the Hungarian cause of Thököly as their official pretext. The Peace of Westphalia forced the Austrian Habsburgs to make a separate peace with France. France would wage war against the Spanish Habsburgs until 1659. This peace was sealed with a marriage pact between France and Spain, Louis XIV consenting to marry the Infanta Maria Theresa, daughter of King Philip IV. Ironically, it was through his Habsburg wife that Louis would begin his assault on the empire, using her claim on the throne to annex Lille and Tournai in the Spanish Netherlands. With the groundwork laid, Louis set out to conquer the Spanish Netherlands, modern-day Belgium, in order to contest the maritime empire of the Dutch. Leopold led the Habsburgs into the bizarre situation of defending the Protestant Dutch, the same Dutch they had attempted to subdue for 80 years. Such was the scale of the threat posed by France. Indeed, it would only be the first of many anti-French coalitions led by Leopold, in association with the Dutch. After 6 years, France would emerge victorious, siphoning the last Burgundian possessions of the Habsburgs in the Free County of Burgundy. Over the ensuing years, Louis convened the Chambers of Reunion to consider ancient French claims on imperial territory dating back to the 9th century. With the presence established at Strasbourg and his sights set on Cologne, it was clear that Louis intended to annex the left bank of the Rhine. As with his cultural policy, Leopold was Louis's mirror in religious policy. Both were hardline anti-Protestants. For Leopold, this did not and could not extend beyond his hereditary domains, but in Hungary, especially the advance of Habsburg power, coincided with the advance of the Catholic Church. Moreover, Leopold was responsible for dissolving the Jewish ghetto in Vienna, the Invert, expelling Jews from his domains. Frederick the Elector of Brandenburg would offer refuge both to the Jews of Austria, affected by the expulsion of Leopold, and the Huguenots of France, affected by Louis XIV's Edict of Fontainebleau. The Ottomans chose this moment, at the height of France's power in Europe, when Louis's claims to Roman Imperium vis-à-vis the Habsburgs and even the Pope seemed irresistible, to lay siege to Vienna. Leopold had been aware of the Ottoman invasion for some time, as Kara Mustafa Pasha had mobilised his forces nearly a year prior to the siege, following a formal declaration of war. It was simply a question of which major city the Ottomans would attack, Krakow in Poland or Vienna. Both seemed possible now that the Ottomans had Hungarian allies posed in what is modern-day Slovakia. Leopold and the Polish king Jan Sobieski committed to come to the other's aid in the event that either city was attacked. Leopold had assembled an impressive army of some 60,000 men. However, this paled in comparison to the Ottoman host, which ranged from 150,000 to 300,000 men. As the Ottomans approached Vienna with little resistance, Leopold and his army retreated up the Danube to Passau, while Count Starhemberg led the defence of the city. Ultimately, it was a coalition of Polish forces under Jan Sobieski and an imperial army under Eugene von Savoy, with detachments from Bavaria and Saxony, that utterly defeated Kara Mustafa Pasha at the gates of Vienna. Over the next 15 years, the Holy League, in what can aptly be described as the last European crusade, drove the Ottomans out of Hungary and Transylvania. Leopold, thanks to his generals Eugene von Savoy and Charles of Lorraine, had presided over the Habsburgs' greatest military victory in the East. But Leopold had no intention of restoring Hungary to her condition prior to the Ottomans, an elected monarchy dominated by the nobility, many of whom had now converted to Protestantism. Leopold's possession of Hungary was to be a Catholic and hereditary kingdom, a bastion of the Counter-Reformation, built upon the precedent he had already set in his little enclave around Pressburg. Louis XIV responded to Austria's reconquest by crossing the Rhine. That same year, the Dutch stadtholder Willem of Orange had orchestrated a coup in England, bringing her over to the anti-French camp. Austria led a grand coalition of the Netherlands, Spain, and England against France, forcing the latter into a stalemate as Austria consolidated her new empire on the Danube. This coalition war, or 9 Years' War, precluded French expansion into the empire. For all his Roman imperial affectations, Louis could not supplant the Habsburgs. Indeed, as Leopold's son Joseph was created hereditary king of Hungary, he was elected king of the Romans. Leopold had led the Habsburgs through this period of tumult, and his empire had weathered both storms from the west and the east. The final problem for Leopold was an issue beyond his control, the ominous cloud descending over Europe that was the imminent failure of the line of Spanish Habsburgs. Charles II, the El Hechizado, the Bewitched, reigned over Spain since infancy, yet no one had anticipated this product of generations of incest, incapable of bearing children, to survive so long. Indeed, when Louis XIV precipitated the Wars of Devolution, in anticipation of his wife's claim to Spain, his actions were premature by 30 years. When Philip IV married his daughter Mary Theresa to Louis XIV, he could not have anticipated that he was handing Spain over to the Bourbons. Spain had an heir in Philip Prospero, the Prince of Asturias, but only 2 years after the Bourbon-Habsburg marriage, Philip was dead, and the sickly Charles was now heir, with his elder daughter and her children by Louis next in line. For a moment, the Habsburg situation in Austria seemed just as precarious. Within 10 years of Leopold's ascension as emperor, his younger brother Charles was dead, his uncle was dead, and his male line cousins in the Tyrol were dead. For the Habsburgs were now simply expected to produce healthy females and sickly males. Leopold's first wife was Margaret Theresa of Spain, a sister of Carlos II. Despite marrying Leopold at the age of 14, a marriage that would only last 6 years until the Empress's untimely death, she produced 4 children and 2 sons, both of whom died in infancy. His second wife, another Habsburg, produced 2 daughters, neither of whom would survive infancy. At the age of 36, Leopold had no clear heir. Any accident could have demised both branches of the House of Habsburg in a single generation. It would take Leopold marrying outside of the Habsburg family into the Wittelsbach of Neuburg for him to at last accomplish his dynastic duty, producing 2 sons who would survive to their majority, Joseph and Karl. Nevertheless, it was only through his first wife, Margaret Theresa, that he could place a direct claim on the Spanish throne, through his daughter, Maria Antonia, and his grandson by the Elector of Bavaria, Joseph Ferdinand. Following the 9 Years' War, the succession question in Spain still loomed, but no party had any interest in resuming a lengthy war following the recent cessation of hostilities. The ambition of France was to see that the Dauphin, Carlos II's closest relative, would inherit, a plan which would see the thrones of France and Spain unite. In secret, France and England contrived a partition plan that would instead see Joseph Ferdinand acquire the throne, his father acquiring the Netherlands and France acquiring southern Italy, with Lombardy granted to the Austrian Habsburgs as compensation. Carlos II would not assent to any treaty that would partition his inheritance, but settled on Joseph Ferdinand as his heir. Had the plan succeeded, the Bavarian Wittelsbachs and neither the Habsburgs nor the Bourbons would have claimed Spain, a plan that was ultimately rendered void when the young prince died of smallpox. Carlos II then designated Louis XIV's grandson, Philip of Anjou, as his heir. The French, hoping that gifting Spain to the younger son, unlikely to inherit in France, would stall any prospect of retribution from Leopold and his allies. Carlos himself had attempted to negotiate a marriage pact between Philip and a Habsburg archduchess to no avail. Instead, this inheritance guaranteed the outbreak of war. Hostilities with the Ottomans had ended the previous year. Eugene of Savoy, the victor of the Battle of Zenta, was sent to anticipate the French in Italy. The Bavarian Wittelsbachs made common cause with the French. Hungary, only recently recovered by the Habsburgs, revolted on cue under their ruling prince, Rákóczi, whose revolt would continue until 1711. The beginning of the war boded ill for Austria against the indefatigable French war machine, able to field significantly more troops than the Allied coalition, with France protected from direct assault thanks to her formidable Vauban fortifications. Nevertheless, Leopold would live long enough to see Eugene von Savoy and his English counterpart, the Duke of Marlborough, change the course of the war with their decisive victory over the French at Blenheim. Blenheim was Leopold's last triumph, enabling him to occupy and exploit Bavaria for the remainder of the war against France. Austria, and not simply the Habsburgs, with particular reference to the Spanish Tercios, established its own reputation as a formidable military power, victorious now against both the Ottomans and the French. In 1705, the year of Leopold's death, Hungary was still in revolt. His hope that Hungary would be conquered in the same sense as Bohemia after Ferdinand's victory in the Battle of White Mountain would never come to pass. Nevertheless, after a reign of nearly half a century, Leopold had doubled the territory of the Austrian Habsburgs. Under his successors, Habsburg rule, no matter how contested or chaotic, would continue in Hungary. His dynastic policy was so successful that at the height of a Europe-spanning conflict, power passed seamlessly to his son Joseph I. Indeed, with his younger son Karl, the hope remained that the Austrian victory in the Spanish War of Succession would be total, allowing the two sons of Leopold to resurrect the two branches of the House of Habsburg, in Spain as in Austria. The devoted Jesuit order would refer to Leopold as Leopold the Great, an epithet granted also to his nemesis and his mirror, Louis XIV. The polymath Gottfried Leibniz wrote an elegy for the deceased emperor, reminiscent of the phrase uttered at the senatorial inauguration of the Roman emperors, to be more fortunate than Augustus and better than Trajan, though in this case, O Habsburg, to thy eternal glory, Leopold, thou hast shown us how to be holy and great, so continue to be both.